Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 787. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, as usual these days, and I have a very special group of friends that are joining. We have two guests today, and we are here for a live recording on EarMeet. Speaking today first with Corey Brock, who serves as minister of St. Columba's Free Church of Scotland in Edinburgh, as well as an adjunct lecturer in theology at Edinburgh Theological Seminary and Belhaven University in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome, Corey. It's great to see you today.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back.
Glad that everything continues to work and that you're connected all the way from Scotland. Thanks for joining us. It's lunch hour here and dinner time for you. And as you mentioned, it's very dark, so we understand what that's like. But we also have with us, delighted to have, his partner here in authorship, Nathaniel Gray Sitanto, who is Assistant Professor of Systematic Theology at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Gray. It's good to see you, too.
Thanks, Camden. It's always good to be back.
Yeah, we love having you both, and I'm glad to have both of you on at the same time. You've been on together. You've been on individually at times, and I get to listen to you regularly because you also contribute and help produce the Grace in Common podcast, along with James Eglinton and Marina DeYoung. I highly recommend that. I listen to every episode. I'm always excited about what you guys have up your sleeves. And look forward to new episodes. What do you have going on in the current season for people who might not be listening? We can encourage them to subscribe and give them an idea of what to expect.
Well, for the new season, hopefully more interviews with some significant scholars. We are anticipating the T.N.T. Clark Handbook to Neo-Calvinism, so particular contributors would probably show up on there. David Koizis on political philosophy and theology. From a neo-Calvinist perspective, we're hoping to have him on. Colin Hansen is also going to be coming on, Lord willing, talking about Tim Keller's intellectual influences. So that's going to be exciting as well. But of course, all things Bovink and Kuiper. Mm-hmm. So we look forward to having you there.
That's great. We appreciate it. You can find that wherever you find your podcasts, Grace in Common, if I remember, and I most likely will. Try to put a link to that in the episode description to make sure people can find it and listen also not only to the new episodes, but to past episodes. There's so much good material there, which you're talking about, much of the same material that we're going to be talking about today. We have a new book in front of us here, Neo-Calvinism, A Theological Introduction, by our guests today, Corey Brock and Grace Sitanto, with a foreword by George Harink. He's been on the program before. We love speaking with Dr. Harink. This book is a wonderful new book published by Lexham Academic. Thankful to them, not only for sending me a copy here to inspect and to read for purposes of this interview, but also to give to us an early supply. So we have about 60 copies of this book. We're selling for sale in the web store. So if you head on over to reformedforum.org, you can get a great deal on the book, $29.99, which is right at or a little bit less than what is for sale on Amazon most of the time. It fluctuates. And free shipping in the U.S. So if you're interested in getting a copy of this book or multiple copies, please head on over to reformedforum.org to get one today while supplies last. We hope to ship them all out. I'd love if we could sell out by the end of the week. So work on that, listeners. We're looking forward to getting this in your hands. But brothers, I wanted to open up here. I know you've done a couple other podcast interviews. I intentionally did not listen to them. I will later. I didn't want to spoil my question preparation and either feel that I was covering the same ground or feeling perhaps the opposite, that I was going in some weird orthogonal direction. So I've tried to maintain the integrity of the interview process here by putting myself in a Faraday cage from all distraction. But opening this up, I have really been enjoying reading this book. I come from as you guys know, and as anyone who's been listening to much of any Christ the Center or Reform Forum stuff knows, very much indebted to the tradition that we find in Voss and Van Til. But both of them are largely indebted also to the Neo-Calvinist tradition. And depending on how we define that, which we'll get into today, it could be called Neo-Calvinists of a type. That'll get into some intramural squabbles in terms of how we use and apply these terms. And I'm excited to get to that. But just to open things up to either of you or both of you, can you describe a bit, the need for this particular book? Why is it, and I think it's needed, but I want to hear what you think. Why is it necessary that we have now a new theological introduction to neo-Calvinism?
Yeah, well, Gray and I studied together at the University of Edinburgh. And when we were there, we were both doing full-time PhDs on Bob Inc. And so digging into his text and reading a lot of the Dutch sources, some that aren't translated. And we realized that as Bob Inc. became more and more popular and people started to read him more as the pinnacle theologian of the neo-Calvinist tradition, that there needed to be an ad fontes, going back to the sources, sort of introductory treatment of what the original neo-Calvinist movement was in the Netherlands. And the reason for that is because, as George says at the beginning of our book, for about a century now, neo-Calvinism just hasn't really developed as a dogmatic tradition. Mm-hmm. It's a tradition that's been more about what it means for the church to engage the culture. And that's a very good question, a very important question, and one that is certainly downstream in the theology of neo-Calvinism, but it's not actually the original question and the original impetus for the movement. And so we wanted to try to go back through and ask the question, what did the neo-Calvinist theologians offer that's distinct in the tradition of Reformed theology? How are they both, as we say, orthodox yet modern, building on the past but building for the future, developing, carrying on the movement and work of theology as we're called to do in every single generation? And they did it in a really unique time period, a time that still we live in, modernity, a time post-industrial, post-French Revolution, post-Kant, Hegel, and Darwin. And so they were kind of the first, you know, in some sense, at least within the Netherlands. This was happening all over, of course, trying to figure out what to do with modernity. And so we think that they're great models. We don't agree with everything they say materially, just like Camden, I have no doubt. You know, you have squabbles with Van Til from time to time.
Sure.
But
you're going to get me kicked out of the tribe, Corey.
sorry. But we think that what they did was actually really important to recover, especially as a model. So that's part of the impetus. I mean, there's a whole other category of why, and that's mm-hmm. bad presentations of the tradition that in the publications. But I'll leave that for Gray. Mm-hmm.
Leave all the plebical stuff to me, Corey.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you know this too, Camden. You know, especially in the North American scene, there's been so many criticisms of neo-Calvinism. And I've also associated neo-Calvinism with a kind of triumphalism, transformationalism, especially with the warnings of certain two kingdom theologians who say, well, neo-Calvinism has an over-realized eschatology. Neo-Calvinism says that we have to just take over culture. It's also often theologically thin, but culturally engaged. And it's just for the sake of being appreciated and accepted by the culture. And what we also realize too, and this is why the Bobbing translations have been so significant, is that those same theologians who criticize neo-Calvinism love Herman Bavinck.
I know.
And one of the which is really interesting. So one of the reasons and one of the hopes for our book is that we can really indicate that you can't like Herman Bavinck and hate neo-Calvinism, because Bavinck and Kuyper are really the progenitors of neo-Calvinism. And whatever permutations arise out of their tradition needs to reconsider their sources. And also recognizing that a lot of these reconstructionism, transformationalism actually deviates a lot from the material foundations of neo-Calvinism from Bobbing and Kuyper themselves. So we felt really convicted about actually just correcting some of these misconceptions that even both of us probably imbibed while we were in seminary in the United States.
Sure. It's very easy to get a real quick assessment of something off of a caricature, and then that becomes just this driving truth in your own mind. It's not a truth yep. per se, but it's hard to get a grasp of the breadth of so much theology, and people take shortcuts. All of us do, but it's important for us to kind of separate maybe what we've heard about something from, you know, an honest appraisal and assessment of primary sources. So you know, it sounds very cliche these days because everyone uses this, and sometimes they use it as a short way to dismiss somebody's criticism. But you say, well, you got to spend time on primary sources. But it's true. We need to. And that gets back to the issue of definitions. It's a bit of a side issue here, but we spoke with Randall Peterson years ago about Puritanism. Puritanism is notoriously difficult to define. It's not necessarily a confessional tradition, although it does pertain to some doctrines and whatnot. Randall Peterson kind of defines, he says, maybe a better approach to trying to get our hands around what Puritanism is this notion of a family resemblance. So if you recognize a family resemblance, literally in a family, the people look similar, brothers, sisters, cousins, parents, children, etc. But yet nobody is the archetype, you know, that somebody might have five of the seven characteristics or four of the seven or whatever, but everyone has their own different mix and match of the characteristics here. My initial thought here was maybe they're going to approach Neo-Calvinism in that way, but I found a much simpler, precise, and a historic definition that you present in the book. So how do you define Neo-Calvinism? Let's set the stage correctly so that we dispel any or attempt to dispel any misconceptions right out the gate in terms of what we're talking about. How do you define this movement historically, theologically?
Well, the family resemblance metaphor is actually really good, and that's one that we appealed to. I think James appealed to it on our podcast once to say something very, very similar to that. So we've talked, Gray and I have talked in other places about sort of the main river and the tributaries is another way. And so we in the book, we're wanting to talk about the main river or, you know, or the original parents or something like that to extend the metaphors. And so we're wanting to talk about it and define it first according to its historical parameters. Now, even in that, we don't treat Groen von Prinster, who's the precursor to the movement. He's the 19th century precursor to that really helped Kuyper understand
his mentor,
his own project. Yeah, his mentor. And I think you can read Unbelief and Revolutions translated. You can read that from him. But we don't treat him. We think that the Neo-Calvinist movement proper really develops around 1880 until about 1920. And 1880, things start to happen, like the rise of the Free University of Amsterdam, where Kuyper realizes there needs to be a university, a Christian university that can seek the organic unity of the sciences under a Christian banner, for example. It's instantiated in the principal theological publication, which is the Reformed Dogmatics of Bavinck, 1892, that starts. And they both die in 1920, 1921. And so in the book, we're treating that movement. Right. It's a movement in the Netherlands for the Netherlands, but then it became international. And that's where the family resemblance and the tributaries begin to break off. And for us, absolutely, Voss and Van Til would be Neo-Calvinist and part of that tributary. Voss more closely being present for part of it in the Netherlands himself. But
so closely, you know, related to and family friends with Bavinck himself and their correspondence.
Right.
At a certain point in time, they're almost identical in terms of whose ideas are, which way are the ideas going. You guys might have certain thoughts about Bavinck, you know, being the source of it all, but I think there's definitely some double direction there.
No, we're not precious about that. No. So Voss shows up in our book on several occasions and J.H. Bavinck, some of the other tributaries do as well. But we wanted to focus on Kuyper and Bavinck. We wanted to focus on, you know, the fathers, for lack of a better term, themselves, so that we could have a reevaluation of the later Neo-Calvinists. And, you know, assessing, when you look at the original sources and ask what exactly were they trying to do in the Netherlands, especially theologically, we can better ask, how does that relate to North American streams in particular that are called Neo-Calvinist down the road? So that's we don't do that in the book, but that's one potential offshoot that could happen.
Sure.
Gray.
That's useful.
Gray, you want
to? But that was a great answer.
Well, I mean, that's helpful to me. And yes, I certainly see the family resemblance metaphor being useful for the perpetuation of Neo-Calvinism. But I appreciate how the book at least is primarily anchored in the figures of Kuyper and Bavinck. So we got something a little bit firmer to grasp onto Whereas in Puritanism, it's maybe a little bit more difficult just to find a couple theological figures and say, okay, now let's look at that movement and see everything that progressed out of there. So a couple questions here then on Neo-Calvinism as it developed and as it perpetuated. I guess I would like to ask you a question that does come up early on in the book, and that's what is Neo about Neo-Calvinism? How does Neo-Calvinism distinguish itself from, or how is it distinguished from just Calvinism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So maybe I'll try to take a stab at it first. So as I've reflected on this question more and more as we're doing all these interviews too, I think we can define it sort of intensively and then extensively. In terms of the intensive sort of direction, it has a more specific sort of connotation. So when Kuyper and Boving talked about the term Calvinism, they were really referring to their inspiration from what Calvin did in Geneva, this understanding that if life is lived before God and his word, then there should be public implications from your theology. And Calvin did this in a specific way in Geneva in a very different context. And so they wanted to take that sort of inspiration and say, what would it look like for us to follow that instinct, that Calvinist instinct, that theology matters for all of life in a new and modern context? So if you take a look at Kuyper's lectures on Calvinism, he refers to Calvinism as a world and life system. And then when you take a look at Boving's article, Future of Calvinism, he says that reform refers to a more distinct theological confession, and so it's a more narrow sort of definition. But Calvinism refers to an entire physiognomy, he argues, this sort of cosmological view of absolutely everything from the perspective of Reformed theology. So a Calvinistic view of culture, of art and science, the idea that the gospel leavens everything that you do. But they recognize that this Calvinist instinct can just be lifted out of Geneva and imported into the modern day in the Netherlands, especially given particular presuppositions and sort of social conditions between church and state. So they wanted to argue, okay, given the modern conditions, how do we recognize that even modernity can't help it but to echo life under God? And even modernity is a kind of what Kuyper calls an atheistic imitation of older Calvinism. And so he starts to reflect on this, and Kuyper argued, therefore, that all the modern ideals of freedom, this idea of authenticity, the ideas of plurality, and the good of democratic liberalism actually find a better home in Reformed theology than they do in modern secularism. So one of the ideas that he retrieved to argue for this is the idea of common grace, right? So why is it that we can be patient with a plurality of worldviews today in a way that secularists could not? Well, he argued that because of common grace, Jesus is Lord and Jesus is calling us to be patient with unbelievers, because he too is saying that in this redemptive historical period, this is the era of God's common grace, is an intermediate state in the sense of the antithesis is not yet eschatologically culminated. That's going to be in the last day when the sheep and the good are going to be separated. That's the time of judgment. So if Jesus is Lord, Christians are not to be called Lord today. Christians are not yet rulers with Christ in the realized sense today. We're called to be coexisting. We're called to be pilgrims on the way. So if we have a so-called Christian nation, we should actually be allowing for worldview diversity to take place in the various structures of life. And Christians are called to lay down your rights in that sense and to be patient because God is patient with the unbeliever. So that's the intensive sense. The extensive sense is just a broader sort of frame of reference, is that they take the Reformed theology of the confessions. So for them, especially things that you would find in the Light and Synopsis and the Three Forms of Unity. And they would say, you know, okay, we have this theological content. How do we recommunicate that in fresh ways in a modern age, in a way that is contextualized to its hearers? So we can have the same theology, but use different philosophical expositions of the same theology. So in the book, for instance, we try to show the ways in which Kuyper and Boving actually uses the terminology of Romanticism to articulate general revelation, for instance, so that revelation produces feelings in the heart, and special revelation reinterprets those feelings and puts language into it, right? So those are very romantic categories: affection, language, precognitive, cognitive articulation, things like that. And they try to develop that in their own particular direction. And so it's the same theology, but communicated in a different mode, different philosophical expositions. That's a broader overview. So another example is organic inspiration, which we covered in the text as well.
Right.
Which is presupposed for us now because of Warfield. And I wonder if Warfield got that as well from Kuyper and Boving. But this idea that God inspires these texts and utilizes the psychological dispositions, histories, personalities of each author. And so that the Bible is not a like Boving would argue, and it's not a book that just fell out of heaven. It's not like the Quran in that respect, right? So it's the same old doctrine of inspiration, presupposing the same exposition of biblical text, but articulating it using that new vocabulary of organism, for instance.
Yeah. These are really important themes. A lot of these themes are explicated and developed in a variety of specific ways on your podcast, which is why I appreciate listening to it each and every week, seeing, you know, kind of taking a jewel and looking at each facet in its own kind of beauty, and then following, to mix metaphors, following a thread for a while and considering these things. So there's a lot of touch points here with many different traditions. You mentioned Old Princeton, Warfield. We think of a lot of other folks. I would love to talk about all these things. We'll get to them in due time. I have too many questions for the time at stake, so I'm going to parse or simplify these things. But one thing you did bring up, which I think is useful to discuss, is there's several things here, but let's speak a bit about Kuyper and Boving's view of the world and the Christian situatedness in there, the eschatology that is at stake. One thing that you bring up quite clearly is the notion, you don't use these, I don't recall you using this term specifically, but the idea is present multiple times in the book, is that both Boving and Kuyper had a sense, especially Boving, that eschatology preceded soteriology. And one of the core things that we love so much at Reform Forum that we seek to emphasize is the deeper Protestant conception of the image of God. That's a phrase that Voss created and developed. But also in light of that, the fact that there is an original plan and purpose, there is a telos, an end to creation, and specifically to man and humanity created in the image of God, that's given at creation. But when the Lord created and placed Adam and Eve in the garden, they weren't intended just to stay in that state forever. Now, some people might think that that's unique to Voss and might not understand perhaps the Neo-Calvinist background to it. Now, I'm not taking anything away from Voss. He developed it in tremendous ways, beautiful ways. But I'd love for you to explain more of this understanding, this eschatology. Sometimes it's said that grace restores nature, but really we could say grace perfects, or grace consummates nature, or grace restores the original intended goal that was implanted in the world at nature. So that's a heck of a lot there, but I'm wondering if you might explain some of those things, especially for our audience who just loves this topic so much.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. There's complete correspondence really in unity on that question and issue between Boving and Kuyper and Voss, and how Voss articulated it with some different language, mm-hmm. but it's very much there in Kuyper and Boving. So grace restores nature is definitely the primary way that both they talked about it, and the tradition after them, especially in the Netherlands, has talked about it. And you helpfully pointed out that there's several ways to say that. So sometimes it can be said grace perfects. I think the clearest way to say it is grace restores and perfects nature, because of what Boving's trying to say with the word restore, right? So in Voss, I think says pretty much the same thing, but the big issue is on the one hand to say, as you put it well, Camden, that what's happened across redemptive history is not plan B, that the point of history has always been that God would sum up all things in Jesus Christ, that Christ, the incarnate second Adam, is to be king of all creation, that for Boving and Kuyper, it's in Christ that we find ultimate organic unity, all things in him. And that the idea of grace restoring nature, you can read there, the work of Christ's grace restoring nature or creation. And then underneath creation, you can think of the natures or substances, humans, animals, whatever you might want to talk about, identities that exist, that language driven from the classical patristic church. But the idea of restoration is so important. And the idea is all about locating the problem. So for Kuyper and Bavinck, grace restores nature precisely because they want to say the problem is not with nature as it is in itself, right? The problem has never been creatureliness or physicality or whatever you want to say, materiality. The problem is ethics. The problem from the beginning is not being created as creature. It's falling. It's sinning. It's rebelling. That our problem is ethical, not in terms of what we are. And so that's what they're trying to emphasize in that restore language. But you're right to say, and this is why I like to add, and perfects, because the idea is not grace gets you back to Eden. It's that grace, the efficacy of the king brings you all the way home. I mean, Kuyper talks about the hope of Adam's maturity in the Garden of Eden. And there's all sorts of different ways we could conceive of it. Obedience obviously being a requirement of that. But the maturation process that was needed to receive the beatific vision, to have God condescend fully and finally into the temple that is the cosmos, grace restores and perfects, meaning restoration is unto that end for Bavinck and Kuyper. So it's not a step backwards, it's entirely a step forward. And so what I wrote in the book is that, I mean, this really is the centerpiece of Neo-Calvinism, Neo-Calvinist theology, for Voss, I think probably for Van Til too, I mean, for everybody, is that the goal of recreation is the very goal of creation itself, that, or eschatology precedes soteriology. Right. We could say it like that too. So yeah, I mean, they're complete union there, I think, on this discussion.
There's an enormous amount to discuss. I'd love to hear your thoughts, Gray, but if I can respond just a bit, just to keep the conversation rolling. We see so much of modern, or I should maybe even say contemporary theology. You guys may not know, but I did my doctoral work on Karl Rahner, who don't have a whole lot in common with theologically. So, but for him, you end up with a beatific vision and salvation being something that God does in order to overcome our finitude. There is a problem with nature. I mean, he's obviously coming from a Roman Catholic perspective, but he coming even from a very liberal, so he gives credence to, you know, some of the basic catechetical definitions in Catholicism, but then advances them in philosophical ways. But he's one example of so many that would present a doctrine of the beatific vision as basically a merger between God and man. So it's not a perfecting of the image of God. Almost the image of God is swallowed up by the divinity, so that what Christ does in the hypostatic union as the eternal Son of God takes on human flesh, he's elevating humanity beyond its creatureliness, which is starkly different from, you know, any historic confessional reform theology, let alone Neo-Calvinism, is trying to present. So I love the healthy doctrine of creation here. I love the eschatology that's inherent within creation from the very beginning. Not to parse or split hairs, but I'm curious, maybe this is a side benefit or a side thing we can discuss sometime, but I don't exactly know Bavinck or Kuyper's view particularly on the necessity of the incarnation, but certainly for Voss and others, that becomes a necessity after the fall, in distinction from maybe a Scotist view or a Thomistic view would say that Christ would have had to become incarnate regardless of if Adam obeyed or not. So we do see all things coming into consummation through the Son, but slightly different from saying that all things come, you know, from the very beginning, come to consummation through Christ as God-man. But anyway, I get the point and agree with you there.
Yeah. I did write an essay called Consummation Anyway, which was published in the Journal of Analytic Theology.
Go ahead. I recall that now. No, I'm not. Don't mean to jump in, but thanks for bringing that up to my attention. I did see that.
Yeah. So, and I try to show that actually what Voss has argued there is in line with the Westminster Standards and Francis Turretin as well, and of course, Herman Bavinck. And again, the idea here is that Adam, had he had been obedient to the covenant of works, would have taken himself and his progeny towards consummation, right?
Yeah.
And so the fall, therefore, did not, the issue with the fall is that it's not just, it didn't leave the image of God intact and just took away donum super additum, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not as if humanity was created with inherent concupiscence and a tendency towards non-being.
Right. That's the Catholic view, the Roman Catholic view, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if, therefore, there's a donum super additum that function as a kind of golden riddle to the sort of intrinsic concupiscence of materiality or mm-hmm. our physical condition. So Bavinck would argue, like the Reformed tradition, Van Maastricht argued this, Tyrton argued this, that original righteousness is intrinsic to our human natures. We were innocent, but yet not consummately perfected. So that's what was promised in the covenant of works, that mm-hmm. you would partake of the tree of life and become consummate. And Bavinck did have a view of on the beatific vision, contrary to some critics of him. But the view on the beatific vision is distinctly Christological in character. So he actually argues, in line with the Protestant principle, in obedience to the covenant of God, what you would have is actually fellowship with God, covenant fellowship Amen. With God. And so after the fall, that covenant fellowship with God is with the person of Jesus Christ,
yes.
and not a kind of deification of your human nature.
Right, yeah. right. But a glorification, a la 1 Corinthians 15, very, very clearly there. You know, that
right.
as we trust in Christ and he consummates all things, we come to partake of the image of the spirit man, the soma pneumaticon, the spiritual body, Christ, the man of heaven, not Adam. And I believe, this is for another day perhaps, but I believe Paul is comparing the resurrected Christ to the pre-fall Adam. Not merely the fallen Adam, although the point would be made even clearer there, but what we have in and through Jesus, again, just to get back to where Corey already started us, gets us to the original intended goal of creation to begin with. So the new heavens and the new earth are not Eden. We see Edenic imagery in Revelation 20 through 22, but that's because it's a consummation of what was instantiated in the garden. I love that.
All right.
On that point, or similar, everything comes back to your dissertation, right, brothers? Like, you know, it's inevitable. Whatever you worked on in your dissertation, like, that is the most important thing. So talking of the development of Neo-Calvinism, we're speaking Kuyper and Bavinck about a historical movement, but you did mention the family resemblance, the various tributaries. Here's a provocative question for you. Is it possible to be an anonymous neo-Calvinist? See, for Bronner, you could be an anonymous Christian. So you could be saved by Jesus Christ, but not know it. So my question is it possible to have theological views that if you were just looking at their views on paper, not knowing who they were, where they were in historical context, etc., but yet you would say that's a neo-Calvinist. Is that possible in your view?
Go ahead, Corey. You're unmuted first. So I just look at who's muted.
Yeah.
It's a fun question. I'm not trying to pin you guys down. I'm asking because people have such a hard time with definitions. But yet people love so much of the neo-Calvinist tradition, but would be critical of it. Mainly because of it's a caricatured view, but anyway.
I mean, I guess my cheeky answer is that there are so many anonymous neo-Calvinists.
Yes.
They're everywhere.
Yes.
So it's a form of universalism? Neo-Calvinist universalism?
Yeah. I mean, the other side of that too, Camden, is that, in the Netherlands, the mid-20th century neo-Calvinism, which can be identified by the public historical markers, you know, being Dutch, being in the neo-Calvinist tradition in terms of the church, you know, you've got somebody like Skilder who denies
the Machen of Canada. I call him the Machen of Canada.
Yeah. You know, he wants to say that Kuyper and Bavinck's definition of common grace needs to be completely changed or replaced. Not completely, and it's very nuanced discussions. Marinus is going to get mad at me, I'm sure, for the way I just put it. But we love Skilder. I think you've got a ton of anonymous neo-Calvinists, especially in North America, and you've got a ton of neo-Calvinists in the Netherlands historically who wouldn't actually subscribe to some of the central tenets. So it's interesting on both sides, but I don't know. Gray, what do you think?
I completely agree. I think if you really believe that there should be a distinction between the institution of the church and the state, that there shouldn't be an established church, that's a very neo-Calvinist perspective. If you believe that your efforts at transformation do not actually carry over in a one-to-one correspondence to the last day, that's actually in line with neo-Calvinism. So I think what happens is that, at least in North American receptions, they take little lines and slogans from neo-Calvinism. They look at what Kuyper says about lordship of Jesus Christ over square inch, and they took a look at what Boving said about the gospel leavening all of life and say, oh, we got to just, you know, transform. I joke in these podcasts that, like, oh, if I put a coffee shop and I call it, you know, Holy Ground or something, then that's the kingdom of God extending to that little corner of Tyson's Corner in Virginia here.
Yeah, but that's not every square inch, brother.
All right, we're leavening it, right? So yeah. you leaven it, and so you buy that building, and that becomes now part of the kingdom of God or something.
You got
and
it.
It's really not their perspective. They argue that there is an apocalyptic transition towards the last day, and so your cultural it's not as if you write a book and it's just going to make it. There's no high continuity in that sort of univocal sense. There is a difference with, say, Van Drunen's perspective, because in his Living in God's Two Kingdoms, he talks about the destruction of this world completely and then a replacement of it with an entirely new cosmos. For Kuyper and Boving, the resurrection is really indicative of this sort of transition. You don't cause your own resurrection. You don't do that by way of incremental advancements, by way of human labor. So definitely lots of, you know, the Voss Van Til thing too. I think a lot of what they're saying is so in line with the neo-Calvinist tradition without knowing it. And I've heard some Vossians and Van Tilians say, we can't be neo-Calvinists. And I'm thinking to myself, then what are you? You know, maybe it's also because Kuyper and Boving were not translated for a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot there. This is probably something for future conversations. I'd love to dive into this more deeply. One thing that's been nagging at me, I've got a file of potential research projects, right? I'm sure you brothers probably have something similar, ongoing questions. But Van Til's letters to his nephew, Henry, are really quite interesting, especially as Henry was so interested in cultural engagement, cultural critique in the neo-Calvinist tradition. So plumbing those, and somebody could easily write a very worthwhile and intriguing dissertation or book on Cornelius Van Til's dependence upon and interaction and potential departure from neo-Calvinist tradition. But, you know, some people would want to define, and I might be one of those, but this is an open question for me, of whether a truly developed pilgrim theology might be considered in distinction, or it's a newly defined sub-tribe under the larger tribe of neo-Calvinism. But you definitely see the pilgrim theology motifs, and more than just motifs, just commitments in Boving and Kuyper as well. So to me, at least, that's something I'm really not equipped at the present to speak on with much detail. But these are the kinds of questions that are interesting to discuss and to analyze. At what point does somebody kind of come from the neo-Calvinist tradition or movement, but yet develop enough where we might give it its own name? You know, I don't know. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a parallel conversation there about Klaus Schilder and Grace in Common. We talked about whether Schilder should be considered a neo-Calvinist because he denied, again, the notions of common grace. I mean, he probably accepted it in concept, but he definitely denied the term. And so much of his work, kind of like Burkhauer in that way, is a critical commentary on Kuyper and Boving in that sense. But, you know, Jamie Smith called Schilder a loyal opponent of the tradition. And so there's something to be said about that. I think, again, you could be a tributary, and there are different tributaries. Doeuwerth is one tributary. I guess Voss and Van Til might be considered another tributary. But they are still reflecting on these sources and not other sources. So I think in that sense, there should be a broader sort of understanding of neo-Calvinism rather than just like overall in antithesis against one another, because we're really close to one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's important too, to say that like that context really matters so much, and that the kind of questions that arise in theological conversation really are derivative of place and time. And it's important, I think, always for North Americans to understand that the Dutch or whoever else might be just aren't talking about the same theological controversies or questions, and then vice versa, that oftentimes I find that the Europeans don't know anything about the conversations that I'd often been a part of in North America. And I think that plays into the who's a neo-Calvinist, who's part of the tradition question.
Yeah. Well,
they're asking, everyone's doing different things. And Van Til developed apologetics in a way that hadn't been done. Right. And you would know better than me, but in terms of how much time and place and question and studying played into that. But again, I'm with Gray that I think everybody's a lot closer than we've all, even across to discussions about the two kingdoms and political theology and all that. I think everybody's actually much, much closer, separated by just slight nuances and degrees than oftentimes we give ourselves credit for.
Let me ask you a follow-up to that, both of you. One of the beautiful things that, at least fertile ideas, fecund ideas, although that sounds dirty, but I mean it, is this notion of Catholicity and ecumenicity that arises here in this neo-Calvinist tradition, something you highlight in the book. That's been on my mind a lot because I've been doing some historical work on Ned Stonehouse, who developed a particular type of Reformed ecumenicity in my own ecclesiastical tradition, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But he also, you know, is a Dutch person and dependent on the similar tradition. But what were Kuyper in particular, but you bleed on into Bavinck if you would like, but what were their thoughts on the Church Universal and their idea of, seeking to develop a theology, and they wanted people to develop, they had certain convictions about what the Bible taught, and they were seeking to explicate a confessional and historic Catholic, small c Catholic theology. But they even had self-awareness they were doing such for a particular historical context and even an ecclesiastical context that would not necessarily be replicated in the same exact way in other places. So holding both of those together, you know, safely guarding the deposit and the truths that were once for all delivered to the saints. So there's a universality to the truths here, but also a situatedness and especially particular questions that are being asked at particular places in time. What were their thoughts on the theology? What undergirded their ecclesiology so that they could develop, you know, this unique approach perhaps to ecumenicity and Catholicity?
I can start, and then I know that Gray will have things to say on this. Two things, maybe just to get started on reflecting on the Catholicity aspect. One is the in terms of theology, the archetypal ectypal distinction of unius is so important, and that's that for them we can never arrive at the final capital T truth. Theology is always in development and must always be in development, and yet we also confess that at the heart of what God has done by the Spirit throughout history, we have captured the essence of Christianity in the creeds and the confessions, particularly for them in its most beautiful form in the Calvinist confessions of the Reformation. And yet, nevertheless, at the same time, because of our finitude and our limitedness, the watchword, the key phrase is we have to look for the truth wherever it can be found. And we have to recognize that every single Christian tradition, especially as it pertains to those that confess the ecumenical creeds, teach us and help us to see that we don't have the whole truth. And so, I mean, Bavinck is a little cheeky in this way. And at when he was in Canada at a conference once, he said that Calvinism was the highest truth, the highest expression of Christian theology, but it's not the whole truth. And people in the audience weren't pleased with him for saying that.
Right.
So he was open, and he says quite often that the fathers of every tradition have to be all of our fathers in some sense. We've got to be willing. Another thing he calls for, I'll just say two more things very quickly. He calls for, in that light, a broad ecclesiology. So that doesn't mean don't be completely committed to the ecclesiological tradition in your own geography underneath the principles of Presbyterianism or Dutch Reformed or whatever it may be. But he simply is talking about an attitude, and that attitude is one that loves the church Catholic, small c, and has a big heart for the church Catholic. And in that way is very willing to seek friendship and unity more than and friendly dialogue and debate and critique, but it's a spirit of ecumenicity built on a doctrine of Reformed Catholicity at the very same time. And so there's a real drive, I think, in the neo-Calvinist heart to look for the truth wherever it can be found, to learn from the best of other traditions. And, you know, Camden, you've imbibed that and done that in many ways and over the years. And so that the two things there that would be central to Calvinist Catholicity. Yeah. Mm.
Great.
Yeah, I think for sure. So it sounds really almost maybe for hearers for the first time, like, oh, Calvinism isn't the only truth. We've got to appreciate all of Christianity, the whole world, and things like that. That sounds incredibly squishy. But there is a kind of there is actually an exclusive sort of foundation for it, because he's arguing that it is Calvinistic Catholicity that allows for that open posture of generosity and gratitude toward God for everything that we can learn from the present. Because oftentimes this polemic is, Roman Catholicism can only produce uniformity.
Yeah, it's a contradiction, as Kuyper said.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Yep, and Foss as well. Yeah. So it's Lutheranism and Anabaptism can only produce separation, but Reformed Catholicity produces this sort of open-minded posture to subversively fulfill, to use Daniel Strange and J.H. Bovink's language, to find a point of contact in any philosophy that we find, and to see all of Christianity as one holistic system, for instance. And so he argues that because of our view of general revelation, common grace, of course presupposing the antithesis, you can't appreciate any philosophical handmaiden, whether Plato, Aristotle, or Kant. And you'd also recognize that grace is only against sin, not against nature or culture as such. And so because of our view of the cultural mandate, then you would recognize that culture is an outgrowth of nature. We are image bearers of God. We will have a vocation to till the earth and things like that. So it sounds squishy, but it actually has that sort of exclusive foundation in Calvinism.
Yeah, I think it's simple enough, or it should be, to get back to what Bovink intended. I think you make this clear in the book. I mean, nobody would say that Calvinism or the Calvinistic creeds and confessions are on par with Scripture. I mean, we shouldn't. That's not a good thing to say.
Shouldn't. Yeah.
But at the same time, we can recognize that it is the most consistent, the most faithful tradition that captures and teaches the system of doctrine that's contained in Scripture. I mean, that's kind of the language that's used in the Westminster Standards. We can hold both things. We can still be Calvinist maximalists and still agree with what Bovink was saying. I think Bovink himself was one. So we're not saying that, this is an arbitrary decision. You can be Calvinist, you can be Arminian, you can be Lutheran, you can be Roman Catholic, whatever. You know, it's not the same as Christianity. No. This isn't arbitrary, but we can't put our own creedal tradition, if it's historically removed from what Christ has revealed in Scripture, we never, you know, because of sola scriptura, never put anything on the level there of God's own word. So that, I think, people that should, I hope, calm some of the fears.
Yeah, that's well said. Exactly.
You know, I can't let you go. We want to get to some questions if we have any, and I can take a look at the Q&A panel for a section. But I also want to respect the time that you guys have agreed to come on here. But I can't let you go, at least without talking about worldview or a world and life view. No doubt you've addressed this on your podcast. Everyone's going to ask you this on all the other podcasts you go on talking about this book. But it's still important, at least, to get on record here and to get discussing it in terms of what Kuyper and Bovink both meant by worldview, and if they have any particular differences with one another on the thought there. But I'm even more interested to understand what they did not mean, because worldview thinking has been, you name it, that's been used in any, for good or for ill, in many different ways in our tradition. So how do you respond to that? Can you add some clarity here, at least from an historical theological perspective?
Yeah, sure. I can start. Gray can mop up after. What worldview means is for them is that, especially for Bhavink, is that it's when one brings religion to bear. Religion meaning theology, but not merely theology. Theology, if we include piety, religion to bear upon philosophy, upon science, and upon art. So, if philosophy is the investigation of relation from the ground up, you know, from what is from the anthropocentric perspective, and theology is redoing that from the top down, worldview develops in the human life very naturally by beginning as an investigative child, becoming a scientist and an artist, meaning a person who wants to create and a person who wants to understand relations between things. All humans are like this. Worldviews arise when first principles come into play. And those first principles become the borders of a map that's being built in a person's life to then try to understand everything within. And so the Christian worldview is when the truths of Christian theology are allowed to bear down and control and give norms for our philosophical, scientific, and artistic investigations of the world. And so that means our Christian worldview is never finished. So what it's not, it means you can never sit back, sit in the armchair, put on your Christian glasses and know what everybody else thinks or ought to think or know what the Christian worldview would say in every instance without having actually studied pretty comprehensively a subject. So the Christian worldview, the Christianity norms geology, but there's so much more to say if you're a geologist. About what a Christian worldview might mean for geology, for example. And so it respects the fact that that the Bible is not a textbook that tells us everything about everything, but it is a book that norms, that tells us how to norm everything. It gives us the system, though it doesn't give us all the details, right? And so a Christian worldview is bringing that to bear on the philosophical, artistic, and scientific realms of reality.
Yeah, and I suppose a Christian worldview, in their sense, wouldn't tell the plumber how to change a pipe, but it would tell the plumber why he's there and how he can glorify God in doing so.
Exactly.
Yep. Ray, any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Corey really, really nailed it there. But it's both a beginning point and an end goal, I suppose. I think at least in sort of higher education, people talk about worldview all the time, but they think about, you attend a worldview seminar and then you attend it for an hour long and then suddenly, boom, you have a Christian worldview on everything, right?
You're qualified to be president now.
Absolutely. Now I have a Christian view of absolutely every detail. But it actually refers to, yes, identifying the first principles and therefore unity in all the subjects. And yet it's also a telos, it's a goal. The Christian worldview is therefore distinct from a Christian's perspective, if that makes sense. It's a holistic corporate vision that we're all as Christians working toward together. So in that sense, it's thinking God's thoughts after him, again, to use something from Voss and Van Til as well. So, and which they got from Bhavink, perhaps, and maybe Bhavink from Kepler. But so that sort of teleological sense of worldview, that inductive sense of worldview, is something that is found in the original sources that perhaps is lost today.
I'll just add one line. And for us, we kind of think, I guess, that most people don't actually have a worldview. And that's probably the difference in traditional worldview thought, traditional, not traditional, later worldview thought, and what we're trying to argue Bhavink and Kuiper understood. And that's to say that worldview is actually something that's really hard work. And it's something that a person seeks after and develops. J.H. Bhavink wants to talk about the difference in worldview and world vision, that everybody has a world vision. It's kind of like Charles Taylor's secular imagination, the imagination, social imagination.
Right.
Everybody's got a social imagination, but usually in the social imagination, things don't actually fit together very well. It doesn't actually all make sense because you haven't done the hard work of investigation and analysis and teleological thinking, mm-hmm. right? And so we want to separate those two out and say we all have social imaginaries, but we don't, we haven't all actually aren't walking down the path of seeking worldview, which is a much more comprehensive and inductive activity.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's really good. If you may indulge us for a moment, I've got a couple questions here. Looking through, there are a lot of them, so let me pick a couple. But Austin writes in and he asks, does the institution-organism distinction have within itself, or does neo-Calvinism in general have a distinct and explicit way of keeping the church from simply being one sphere among many? I wonder if you might comment on that, the institution and organism distinction relative to the church and its relationship to the world.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can say something mm-hmm. briefly. For Kuyper, the church is the sphere. The church is the sphere that norms all spheres. So the church has the most important role in amongst his notion of sphere sovereignty, and so yeah. I mean, I can put it as simply as that. Absolutely, the church tries to discipline all the other spheres in a positive way. Disciple by showing the family what it can be in the light of Christ and recreation, by showing the state what it is and what it ought to be, the wing of jurisdiction over justice, but only one that acknowledges that God is the giver of moral law. The church teaches and disciplines or disciples every other sphere, so it becomes the norm of all spheres and teaches in every other sphere what it would mean for it to be holy, set apart, consecrated for good, if you will.
Thank you. This might be opening a can of worms. We can trim this if necessary. But someone is asking, Neil asks, would the term neo-Calvinism give credence to the objections of the Protestant Reformed Church of North America? I'm thinking more specifically about the debates. I'm talking now, this isn't Neil's question, but adding to this and maybe contextualizing a little bit, we think about the debates over common grace back in the early 20th century in the Christian Reformed churches of North America, which, if my history is correct, eventually gave rise to the PRs, what they're known as the PR, the Protestant Reform Movement. If there is someone coming up or a movement that arises, from the general family tree of neo-Calvinism, is common grace or the notion of common grace there now really kind of an essential component? Or I guess how far can one go in rejecting some of the features of neo-Calvinism until it really doesn't make much sense to call them neo-Calvinist anymore? Any thoughts? That's
a great question. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I know everything about the Protestant Reformed Church of North America, but I think, I remember reading Cornelius Van Til's Common Grace and the Gospel on mm-hmm. this. I think he's got some wonderful statements there on defending common grace. And I think, again, most people, it seems to me, reject common grace because it seems in their minds that common grace baptizes non-Christian cultural activity. It mm-hmm. kind of positively affirms it. It dilutes the distinctness of the church. But one of the things that we try to say in our book, anyway, is that common grace doesn't seem to make sense without the antithesis, because it's a redundant and superfluous doctrine without the antithesis. So common grace explains why the antithesis is not yet eschatologically fulfilled, why the antithesis is in principle rather than in practice oftentimes. So without the antithesis, so if you just say there is no antithesis, then you don't need the doctrine of common grace,
right?
Because we just are sort of mutually naturally in allegiance or in commonness with one another anyway. So it's a great question, but I don't know much about the actual PR movement today.
Sure. It's something for people to look into, just in terms of hyper-Calvinism as well. And that's part of the historical context here back in the 20s on into the 40s, the circumstances that gave rise to Van Til's book and some of the debates in the OPC regarding the free offer of the gospel. Van Til and Murray were involved there. Sorry to jump in, Corey.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the things we got to say is that analogical reasoning helps us a lot there, because it causes us to embrace paradox or to anticipate paradox. And so that's one of the benefits of that debate, tending to it. Go ahead, Corey.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we're certainly not the gatekeepers for
We don't have to apply for a membership with you two.
You know, in some ways, it's like, well, do you want to be a neo-Calvinist? Then come on. I mean, you're welcome.
Is there a hazing? Is there a pledging semester or something?
Common grace is really important in the logic of the overall theology. However, there are plenty of, especially Dutch neo-Calvinists that, like Skilder, who have a different view. So, no, I don't think you have to. I think you can be a neo-Calvinist in many ways and not believe in common grace. As long as you have a way of talking about it that replaces what it does, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people get Skilder. Go ahead, Skilder.
Yeah, Skilder, you know, replaces the term common grace as common temperance. So when that paragraph came, I was like rolling my eyes a little bit. So,
and the cultural mandate.
That's right, cultural mandate, common temperance. Yeah.
Yeah.
It does throw people for a loop, and it helps us to get back to definitions again. What is meant by grace? We're not talking about salvation here, or the
right.
But we're trying to make sense of the fact that God has not yet come back in final judgment, and yet. You know, people born in sin are children of wrath like the rest of mankind, but there's a point in time, Ephesians 2, 5 through 7, at which the elect are saved. And so how do we reckon with redemptive history? I mean that very specifically.
Yep.
Reckon with redemptive history in light of the eternal decree.
Yep.
And et cetera. They're complicated issues, but this is well-trod ground that people can look at historically. One final question from me, but this is in service of not only myself, but all the listeners and viewers. One thing that I appreciate about your podcast is the fact that you emphasize you have people from four different continents, you know, originally. It's very useful, at least two or three continents, sorry. I know my geography. But four different countries originally. And you got to get an Antarctican in there somehow. I don't know if there are neo-Calvinists there, but that would be neat. But you have a perspective on global Christianity that's helpful for a lot of folks in North American tradition. Many of us haven't even been out of the country ever. But where are some places we might go, some ways in which people might broaden their ecclesiastical and theological horizons, things we might read, things we might digest, or people or places where we might be involved in order to give us a more global perspective on some of these issues? How would you encourage or exhort maybe our listeners to a broader view of Christ's work in the church?
That's a great question. I mean, if you can do it, I know this is a luxury for many people, but if you can do it, travel a little bit and visit your brothers and sisters in different churches around the world. You know, actually, the neo-Calvinist tradition has a very lively reception in places like China, Korea, parts of Japan, Indonesia, of course, and the Philippines as well. So recognizing that they're actually drawing from very distinct sort of emphases within neo-Calvinism. So I think, you know, in the North American sphere, the two kingdom versus neo-Calvinism dichotomy has kind of filtered the debate a little bit without recognizing that in a lot of ways, two kingdom theology, we would now suggest, is sort of a permutation of neo-Calvinism itself, we would argue. But that's not the debate in the Netherlands. The Netherlands is more about if worldview is inductive, if the university is a whole organism, then in what ways can we continue to develop that organism? Is there room for modifying previously held commitments without actually denying the essence of Christianity? Those are the sort of debates they're having. Mm. Maybe you have a little bit of that too in the context of second, third generation Calvin College, perhaps, or Calvin University now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the main debate in the Netherlands. So not so much two kingdom versus neo-Calvinism. And the Thomas versus Van Til thing, too, is a very American thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the debate in the Netherlands. The debate, again, there about uses of philosophy is more so about, not about Aristotle versus idealism, but again, more about, you know, wrestling with Darwinism and things like that. So zooming out of those debates would hopefully put a perspective on those debates and be able to, therefore, engage with them with higher charity. In China, it's more so about church-state relations because they're thinking about house churches and how should Christian communities be distinct in a context where they have to be underground in a lot of ways. In Indonesia, it's about pluralism because Indonesia is such a plural, diverse country. What does it look like to engage with all these different religions from a different perspective, from a distinctly Christian perspective? So if you can travel, if you can't, of course, you know, I think America is such a wonderful melting pot of different cultures and communities. So I'm not saying every culture needs to be, every church needs to be multi-ethnic, but your church should reflect the culture that you're in and the city and the town that you're in. And most likely, at least if you're around here in Northern Virginia, in a lot of ways, when we were in Philly, Camden, you know, you can go a couple miles down the road and you'll meet people very different from you. So
that's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Any thoughts, Corey? What's it look like in Scotland?
Yeah, that was a great answer. Well, I was just going to say that I can say something about Scotland, but I was going to say that, one, it's been I've been somewhat involved in Latin America and seeing just going down from time to time.
Yeah,
and seeing
me too.
Reform Christianity across Latin America and how it's developed. And as the Neo-Calvin, as Bavinck and Kuyper would say, how Christianity is capable of entering into and using and leavening every single culture. And like Grace said, I mean, it's amazing to travel and go see how much Reformed Christianity is growing all over the globe. And our T&T Clark handbook that we have coming out in 2024 on Neo-Calvinism has 40 authors across six continents. So the only one we don't have, we're missing one. Is Antarctica, and now after this, I'm gonna do everything I can to.
I just saw a huge iceberg just broke off from Antarctica just today. I think maybe there's somebody on that is drifting across the ocean. And they might come nearer.
I mean, we'll go evangelize. We'll evangelize and disciple until we have somebody that can write from Antarctica.
You got it.
I mean, reading. If you can't travel, reading widely. You know, reading outside your own Christian tradition is really important too. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Scotland, the last thing I'll say is it's for me, this is just my personal experience. I grew up in Mississippi. I'm a Bible Belt kid, Southern Baptist, become PCA. And it's been very helpful for me to understand how different ministry and theological development occurs and is in a entirely post-Christian context versus one that was still very much in the domains of Christendom. And the winds are shifting. Even if you live in a Christendom domain right now, the winds are shifting. And so it can be very helpful to theological development and ministry development to go spend some time in a place that has the city of Edinburgh has about maybe a 2% Christian population, we think, 2 to 3 now. And so, you know, that it changes your perspective depending on where you live and what the theological themes really need to be. What theological themes really need to be emphasized change depending on place. And I've learned that very much moving back and forth between Mississippi and Scotland and how I've done ministry in the different places and learned from others is very different. So,
well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. We take that exhortation. I hope most people will take that to heart as well and seek to find ways to broaden their horizons for the sake of Christ and for our own benefit, obviously, to have a bigger view. That's perhaps the thing I was surprising to a degree, but the thing that I appreciated most about going down to Colombia a couple times was just the broader view to see the way the Lord is working and with other confessional Reformed Christians. I wasn't even, you know, branching out that far in terms of confessional tradition, but it was eye-opening, heart-opening, if I don't bleed too much into those romantic categories, brothers. But this has been really fun. Perhaps we can continue the conversation sometime, but I really appreciate both of you joining me today, Corey and Gray. Thanks for writing the book. Thanks for speaking with us. We really appreciate it. It's been a blessing.
Thanks so much, Camden. It's great.
I do want to point people to the Grace in Common podcast. You can find that online. We'll have links to that in the episode description. But for the moment, even more significantly, we've got a reflection. How precious this is to me. I've wrapped it in my protective sleeve, but now it's reflecting. The book we have, Neo-Calvinism, A Theological Tradition, by Corey Brock and Grace Otanto, forward by George Horink. Forward itself is tremendous. published by Lexham Academic. Get a copy today. It's a beautiful hardcover, really nice paper. It's bound well. This is going to last for a long time. We have several copies, 60-ish copies available at the moment at reformedforum.org. You can get it for $29.99 US, and we'll ship it to you free in the States. It's also available on Amazon and wherever good Reformed books are sold. But buy from us first so we can send these out. We'd really like that. Appreciate it. Again, I want to thank not only our guests for joining us, but I do want to thank everybody for watching live. I hope to have this episode produced and in the feed ASAP, Lord willing, even by tomorrow. But for everyone who's listening and watching, no matter where or when, we want to thank you. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.